On our program today, we should have a very interesting discussion. It's an extremely timely topic and a popular one for WFAN at this time of the year, and realistically, the broader discussion at any time of the year. Good guest is joining us. His name is Thomas Gagliano. Tom Gagliano's background is as an author, a keynote speaker, a life coach. He's an addiction specialist. He has helped institutions and individuals around the country with a unique approach to parenting and with relationships. He has this background where he's going to share some information with us on this topic of addiction, because this time of the year we also get into, naturally, talking about folks who have an addiction when it comes to the idea of betting and gambling specifically. It was a lot of different things we're going to explore in our discussion with Tom. Tom, good morning, first of all. Welcome to WFAN.
Bob, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you being with us. As I mentioned in introducing you, you know, the topic of gambling addiction is one that we've covered a number of times on this program previously. In a way, it's part of the reason why this program is still in existence, because the very first time we covered the topic, in 2 hours' time on the air, guest who was on with us at that time, and I talked with 22 people. I think the youngest person who called the show that day, if I remember correctly, was 12 years old. The oldest was somebody in their 80s. We had somebody who was a bookie. We had people who were at that time coming back from traveling to a casino or casinos in Atlantic City. And, of course, the proliferation of gambling has exploded since that time, legalized
sure.
gambling,
sure.
let alone the other forms of gambling that there are. Obviously, there's a lot of excitement talk surrounding the Super Bowl. But let me ask you a question right at the start here, because this always comes up in discussions.
Yeah.
How does somebody know when they have a problem when it comes to gambling?
The first gambling is the symptom. Like drinking is the symptom. Like drugs are the symptom. The real problem really is negative core beliefs. Now, that's what makes some people gamble and have fun, and other people gamble to fill a void inside. They're filling something that they can't get from gambling, just like the alcoholic keeps filling themselves with more alcohol, thinking they're going to fill a void inside. So really, that's where it comes to. In answer to your question, okay, really there's different areas where you really know, oh boy, I may have a gambling problem. First of all, one of the obvious ones is I'm gambling more than I ever thought I would. I'm crossing a line. I never thought I would bet this much on a game, and I did. I never thought I would borrow money to gamble, and I did. I never thought I would take money from my kids or wife on the sneak, and I did. But when you really know you have a gambling problem is when you do one of these few things, okay? You're losing time at work from gambling. You're in jeopardy of losing your job. You know, gambling is like a ritualistic thing, too. You know, the guy that gambles on Sunday football, he's just not putting bets in on Sunday. There's a whole ritual that goes into that, and it's going into that all week long, looking at lines, looking at weather, looking at who's hurt, who's not hurt. It's a compulsion in itself way before you actually gamble. So if you're losing time at work, you have to look at that. If you can't pay your bills and you're sneaking things and you're hurting your family, your wife doesn't know, your husband doesn't know. If you're doing things on the sneak, you have to look at that. You've crossed a line. You could be a compulsive gambler. If you're borrowing money from the wrong people, and that's another area where you might be a compulsive gambler. And also, if you're facing legal charges, you know, there's a lot of guys out there that are gambling more than they have, and they're taking the money in areas they shouldn't be taking money at, and they're getting in trouble legally. So those are a few of the areas that if you're participating in these areas, you have to look and say, whoa, this is no longer fun. Now I'm really hurting a lot of people.
On the other side are the people who say, well, wait a minute. You know, this is something that proliferates with office pools. There are all kinds of betting opportunities, and there are different ones, and there are people who will say that they have a level of control when it comes to gambling. How do you respond to that?
I respond to that this way. The cemetery is filled with compulsive gamblers that thought they were in control of their addiction. It's a powerful statement, right?
Mm-hmm.
Full, you know, there's a lot of people that commit suicide over gambling. One of the highest out of all addictions is compulsive gamblers. So, you know, the gambler always thinks they're in control. The problem is the addiction is in control of the gambler, and they don't know it. They don't know it until, you know, you have, we have prisons that have compulsive gamblers in there. Do you really think they thought they were going to be in jail the first few times they made a bet?
No.
Right. So, you know, what makes one person have fun and another person gamble compulsively? Now, you have all different masks out there. You have rich people that are compulsive gamblers that get themselves in trouble, poor people. You have people from all religions. You have people from all colors of skins out there that get in trouble with gambling. What makes one person gamble to have fun and another person either lose his family, go to jail, or lose their job?
Well, what is it?
It's the inner void. It comes from childhood. See, that's where the problem really lies. You know, for me, Bob, I had a dad that was multiply addicted, as I am. I'm a compulsive gambler. I'm multiply blessed. And I had a dad that didn't come home at a certain time, and then he was going to come home drunk. And he was out gambling, and he's out drinking. Now, at a young age, Bob, I never said to myself, gee, my dad suffers from this addiction called alcohol and gambling. No. I said, what's the matter with me that my dad doesn't want to be with me? Those negative core beliefs started early with a child, early, develop into a whole mess of negative inner voices, negative stories, until eventually that pain gets acted out. Not me. I'm talking about anybody from a challenging childhood. It will be acted out with drinking, gambling, or acted in with depression, isolation. So really the root of the problem is always coming from the negative core belief, the negative sense of self, the need to medicate that through some action that makes me feel good about myself. Now, for me, being a compulsive gambler, okay, I always thought I'm gambling to win money.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the obvious thing you would say to yourself. Not realizing that there was no money out there to a compulsive gambler you can win enough of to stop gambling unless you get help. I was making a fortune in business, was gambling away two fortunes, till my wife left me, which she should have. She should have. I don't blame her. I wasn't showing up as a healthy adult, as a husband, as a son. So I had to fix what was broken inside of me in order to stop my gambling. I had to look at those unswept corners of my life, like, why am I sabotaging? And most compulsive gamblers, most addicts, will sabotage their relationships. See, I believe childhood messages early on will affect the intimacy we have or don't have, our parenting skills, the careers we choose, even the roles we play, the addictive role, the compulsive gambler role. Everything comes from that. You know, Bob, I had about a few years ago, my son, we're watching a football game, and he says to me, hey, Dad, how come the kids in the stand root so hard for their favorite football play? He's 8 years old. I said, well, those football plays are the heroes. And he stopped and he thought about what I said. He came back, he said, you know, Dad, they may be my hero someday, but you're always going to be my first hero.
Hmm.
Very powerful message.
Right.
And he taught me that as parents, we are our children's first heroes. So everything that they gain from those early years, from 5 to 10, develop how they feel about themselves. And if we're nurturing them, if we're saying, hey, what's up, kid? How you doing? How you doing in school? What's going on? If we're curious with them, if we show them that they matter, that's somebody that will grow up without needing something to make them feel whole. You with me?
I'm with you completely. And, you know, there's something I want to bring up. We're going to take a pause for a few messages in a moment here. But when we come back, I want you to address as well what it is that you have said to your son about your experience growing up, you know, with your father's background.
Great question.
As a way of perhaps being able to enlighten him, because it sounds like you've had some of these heart-to-heart discussions in a way.
Great.
We've got a lot to get into in this discussion. We're talking with Tom Gagliano on our program On the Fan.
Love listening to your favorite stations online? Download the Radio.com app to get on-the-go access to hundreds of HD radio stations, award-winning podcasts, and top entertainment and music articles. Go to apps.radio.com for more information or download today from the iTunes Store or Google Play.
There's something for every sports fan on CBSLocalSports.com. Watch live radio shows and original video programming while reading national articles from some of the best writers in the country. Visit CBSLocalSports.com today.
We're in discussion with Tom Gagliano on our program. Tom is an addiction specialist, a life coach, keynote speaker, and author. By the way, I forgot to mention earlier in our discussion, your first book was entitled The Problem Was Me. There's a lot of different things I want to explore in our talk with you today. We're talking about this idea of addiction with gambling, obviously, in line with the Super Bowl next week. I posed a question to you before we paused for mm-hmm. our sports update and messages about what it is that you've said to your son about your dad and his addictions.
Well, let me segue real quick and tell you that my dad, I knew my dad loved me, but he was a tortured soul. So when I was a kid, I was always really good in sports, tough, always in fights, angry inside. And if I should, God forbid, share feelings, my dad would address me as his little girl.
Mm.
That's how he spoke to me. Come on, little girl. So the message was clear. Do not share feelings. If dad's not safe, no one in this world is safe. Nobody, I could trust nobody, which is the common denominator for all addicts. They don't trust any process that they can't control. That's why asking for help becomes so tough, because they got to give up that control. So let me segue now into your question. I had a situation, and the most important thing we can do for our children, addict or not, is create a safe place for our children where they could share their feelings, their struggles, their curiosities with addictions, whatever that is. Because if a kid doesn't have someone safe at home to share their struggles with, there's a good shot they're going to solicit that info from the wrong people, and we don't want that as parents. And they're going to develop negative core beliefs. Like, if I can't talk to my mom or dad, then who can I talk to? What's the matter with me? Egocentricity. So now, had a situation where we had to put our dog to sleep. My son grew up with this dog. He's very, very close to this dog. And I knew I had to do something, Bob, a little bit differently than how I grew up. And I remember walking in the room after we put the dog to sleep. And I said, are you doing okay? He says, yeah, Dad, I'm doing okay. Well, I went over to him, very different action for someone like me. And I put his arms around me, and I put his head on my chest. Within a few minutes, he started to cry, and his tears intensified, and his grip on me intensified. I knew that day that I was giving him a safe place, a place to cry in his father's arms. It was a place, Bob, I never had as a kid myself, but I knew that's what I had to do in order to create a feeling in my son that he mattered. He was important. And I've taught my children that they can make mistakes in life. Doesn't mean they are a mistake, that they're going to fail in life. But that doesn't mean they are a failure. All of these messages that I'm talking to you about now segue into creating somebody that grows up and doesn't need something external to make them feel whole inside. And I had another situation with my younger kid last year. He came to me and he said, you know, Dad, some of my friends smoke weed. He says, and they're telling me I should try it. They're telling me that it feels great. Now, I'm a recovering addict. He knows I'm a recovering addict. I told him my story. He knows my father's story. Bob, the first thing I wanted to do was say, go in your room till you're 26 years old and I'll let you out. That was the first thing I wanted to tell him. I'll let you know when you come out of your room. Of course. But I didn't. I paused. And I was curious. I says, what do you know about weed? What do you know about addiction? And he told me, Dad, I know that addiction hurts a lot of families. It hurts people that you love. And I validated what he said. I said, that was very insightful. See, I was curious. I wanted to know how he felt. And then we went on the internet and we looked up, there's an American Epidemic, themovie.com. It's a great CD on drugs, on where you can go from pot to drugs. So we watched it together. And I told him, you know, I want to tell you something else too. You have to be responsible for the choices you make. If you choose to break the law, you also have made the choice to go to jail. See, we need to teach our children that their choices create consequences. If I don't clean my room, I chose not to get my allowance. If I don't come home at 8 o'clock, I chose not to go out the next day. See, the consequences can't be you're a bad kid and you deserve to be punished message.
Mm-hmm.
The consequences need to be you're a good kid, but you got to be responsible for the choices you make. So getting back to that story, a couple of weeks later, I went to him and I said to him, hey, what happened with the weed? He said, you know, Dad, I don't hang out with those kids anymore. Now, the moral of the story, Bob, is I could have tried to control his actions.
Right.
I could have twisted the arm, put him in his in the closet, see? Put him in his room and done all of that stuff. But what I teach parents in the groups I facilitate for recovering addicts is instead of trying to control your child, try and supply them with the tools to control their own behavior. Teach healthy habits so that they could make healthy decisions on their own. That's what I try to teach.
How is that message received by most parents?
Oh, look, the more afraid a parent is, the more a parent tries to control. It's mm-hmm. like a knee-jerk reaction. You know, I said to you earlier that the compulsive gambling really isn't the problem, it's the symptom?
Right.
Well, it's the same thing with parents. Parents get really afraid that their child is... That's what creates that helicopter parent or the parent that rushes in all the time. They get really afraid. And when people get really afraid, their knee-jerk reaction is, let me control the process. Let me control the situation. And what we do when we do that, we're not teaching our children how to deal with life or cope with life on life's terms. They don't develop coping mechanisms. They need to learn to get out of their own messes. And if they don't do that, they're going to grow up with a lack of self-esteem, and the world will overwhelm them.
You know, I mentioned that your first book was titled The Problem Was Me. People who are listening to our discussion today may be wondering the answer to the question I posed to you. Where did your insight or insights that have led you in the direction that you've shared with us, where did that come from?
There's no greater teacher, Bob, than life. Life will kick your butt in plain English. And that's what happened to me. My wife left me. I had to make a choice, and I had to change. But I'll tell you, one of the most powerful moments in my life, believe it or not, came from my dad, of all people, the person that really, you know, abused me the most, physically and mentally. He was very ill. He was in the hospital, and he had cancer, and I had no relationship with him. My mother had called me and said, listen, I think you should visit your dad. The cancer spread. He's very ill. I don't think he has long to live. Bob, and I went to the hospital that night, right over here in Jersey, near Rutgers here. And I sat down near him, and he was very frail. You know, the cancer, you could see it ravaged his whole body.
Mm-hmm.
And I got up to leave. And he said, sit down for a minute. I want to tell you something. And he said in a very frail voice, he said, you know, my father was dying, that would be my grandfather, 20 years ago, and I was sitting right where you were sitting, and I could never tell him how I felt. I could never tell him I loved him. And I don't want that to happen to you. I don't want you to go through that pain. Now, you got to remember, Bob, I'm a guy who grew up with no intimacy. Nobody's getting close. That's part of what creates the addictive mentality. And I just wanted to run out of that room. So I touched his hand, and he pulled me close, and he started to cry. I never saw my father cry, except when I was a kid, if he would beat me to a pulp, he would come in later in a drunken stoop and say, please forgive me, I'm sorry, I didn't mean this. But these tears were really real tears. But here's the thing. I got out of that room feeling tremendous pain inside, and I didn't know what to do with that pain. And anybody listening to this show that's a recovering addict, or knows a recovering addict, when you're in a lot of pain, you're going to go one of two ways. You're either going back to your addiction, or you're going to go to your support group, whoever that is, your recovery group. Maybe that's a sponsor. Maybe that's a therapist, a priest, a rabbi, a minister. There's no middle road. The middle road is addiction. And I remember walking out of that room really in bad shape. I wanted to go just lose myself in gambling. I wanted to bet every team that came on the TV to numb that pain. And here's the, I guess, if you want to call it a spiritual moment. The elevator door opened, and out popped a guy from one of the meetings I went to. He just happened to have been visiting somebody else in the hospital that day. And I remember walking over to him, and man, Bob, I gave him a hug. He must have said, I didn't know Tom liked me this much. This guy really likes me. Wow. But he was there for me. And after that point, and after I went to the wake and the funeral, my father died. I read his journals, and I really saw he wasn't a monster. He was a human being.
Mm-hmm.
Same person I was, same demons I had. And at the wake and funeral, to my surprise, was guys that I developed friendships with from meetings, from groups, and they're all there for me. And I got to tell you, Bob, that was what I was missing as a kid. I felt so special at that moment, so important to these people. Something I just never got as a kid. And I'm not blaming my father. I mean, this is just the reality of feelings. And feelings aren't true and false, right or wrong. They're feelings. And after that, I said, you know what? I think I know what I got to do. And I moved away from the world of business, which I was pretty successful at. And I started to facilitate groups free of charge in my house and in a church, helping those who suffered from negative childhood messages to free themselves from the prison of those messages. And then, ironically, I wrote my book, and I had to come up with a name for my book. And every time I asked my wife a name, she would go, that's never liked any name I gave her. And finally, I walked in, I said, I got it. The problem was me. She says, now you got the title right. Finally got it right. And that's how I went for my book. I went for my master's degree at 51. And then this is what I do today.
You know, as you're sharing your experience with us, you said something that I found very interesting. The idea that, you know, your father had not communicated these thoughts with you over the years, but he had journaled.
Yeah.
Which I find amazing, because that's a way of communicating those thoughts and those feelings. Maybe it's not directly with another person, but it's in a way part of his legacy, part of his connection and communication with you, even after he's not physically here.
Right. Right. And it did bring me closer towards him, like
exactly.
You said.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hmm. And you know, he's a man like myself that early on in life was given negative. My father, another great business person, always, and many compulsive gamblers are very good business people. They know how to make things work. And my father also learned early on in life that people weren't safe. If I trust, I get hurt. If I cry in front of my dad, I'm his little girl. He had worse messaging than I had. So people aren't safe. Therefore, maybe journaling safe. And, you know, all of us, Bob, all of us at a young age, we want to feel important. We want to feel valued, especially to those people that we love, especially to our gods who are our parents at that age. And if we don't feel that, we look for it in the wrong places. That's what addiction is. You know, people become so, it's so powerful. That's what you hear all the time. It's easy to stop an addiction, Bob, but what's tough is staying stopped because it's so powerful. It keeps coming to you saying, I can give you what you need. I could make you whole. I can make you feel important. That's why I talk to people about looking under those unswept corners of their lives, because it's all connected. It's like a jigsaw puzzle when clients come to me. They got pieces all over the place. But when we start to go back on those childhood messages, the anger that they've carried their whole life, the resentments, the shame, and they start to give that back, free themselves, the jigsaw puzzle, the pieces start to connect then. It's an amazing thing.
Mm. It's very powerful, and, you know, there's a lot that you're sharing with us that I know people who are listening to this discussion are connecting with, because over the years, again, we've done a lot of different shows on different aspects of recovery and addiction, and usually the feedback is that it's right on in terms of connecting with people listening to us, so we will continue in that vein in our talk with Thomas Gagliano.
Know what's going on with your favorite artists, bands, and celebs. Sign up today to get the Radio.com daily newsletter, which covers all your breaking music and entertainment news. Go to Radio.com/newsletter to get updates directly to your inbox. That's Radio.com/newsletter.
Listen. Listen to CBS Sports Radio every weekend for nonstop sports updates and breaking news, including analysis of the hottest topics in sports.
CBS Sports Radio.
CBS Sports Radio.
Listen live every weekend on air or online at CBSSportsRadio.com.
We are in a discussion with Tom Gagliano on our program. He is talking with us about this topic of addiction. He's an addiction specialist, life coach, keynote speaker, and author. His first book was entitled The Problem Was Me, and he's joined us by phone on our program. When we talk about the idea of recovery, I say that word to you. I've used it a couple of different times thus far in our discussion. What does that mean?
Great question, Bob. You know, we talk about recovery, we think of things like alcoholism, we think of things that are like gambling, but recovery could be many different things. It could be somebody that overeats, it could be somebody that, it could be a people pleaser. You know, when I talk about the roles we set up to play in childhood, I go back to your viewers. How many people listening to the show play the role of a people pleaser, where they say yes all the time? Sometimes they want to say no, but there's a little voice inside of them that says, oh, you're a bad person if you say no. That's also recovery. To recover away from the things you've done your whole life and to be the person you want to be true to yourself, is so important because, you know, at the end of the day, Bob, the most important relationship all of us have is the one we have with ourselves, not with our spouse or kids or parents. It's the one we have with ourselves. So recovery could be any area where you want to grow and change a role you're playing. It doesn't necessarily have to be such a blatant role like drinking or gambling. It could be any role that you want to break because you want to free yourself and become a happier person.
That idea of the most important role being or relationship being to be true to yourself, in doing that, in being true to oneself, is that also for some people the toughest role that they ever have to play?
Oh, yeah. Especially, again, you know, again, I know I keep bringing you back to childhood, Bob. That's just how I view the world. And, you know, especially when you're young and you see mom and dad at the top of the pyramid there. And when mom and dad are nurturing each other in a healthy way, physically, emotionally, mentally, a child just has to be a child. That's all a child has to be. But when a child senses there's problems up there, problems going on up there, some children become parentified. All of a sudden, they have to start filling those voids. And that's, to me, how the roles start to be created. And again, if they see their parents in addictive roles, if the coping mechanism is to watch football all day, make bets, and not pay attention to anything, if that's how you cope with life or cope with drinking or doing all of these things, if that's what they see as coping mechanisms, there's a good shot that they will play that role as they get older, and they'll pick up some addictions in some form.
So if that's the case, then how do we explain those who not only pick up one addiction, in some cases two, but they have multiple addictions where it seems like it's just one thing after another that they are overdoing?
You know what I call that? Switching seats on a Titanic. Okay? Basically, if you don't fix the problem, remember I said those symptoms? They're all symptoms. I can stop drinking, but if I'm not fixing what's broken in me, I'll gamble, or I'll spend, or I'll watch pornography all day, or I'll... You got it?
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm not addressing what the real problem is, I've had many people come to me. I remember a gentleman that owned a restaurant used to go. He goes, you know, I don't like this 12-step Gambling Anonymous program. I stopped gambling on my own. I didn't need the program. And I remember saying, okay, let's see what happens with this guy. He stopped gambling. He became an alcoholic. So he was looking to escape in a different way. He thought he had it. He won. He stopped gambling. But it's not the gambling. It's the escape. And if I put a cork on my drinking, I'll find something else unless I fix that brokenness inside.
The idea of support...
Everything.
How key is that to real recovery?
It's everything. It's everything. Everybody in the groups I run are on text messages to each other. Recovery is a we process, not a me process. We need to solicit the help of other loving people, not judgmental people. Not to call somebody up and say, and somebody tell you, what the heck's the matter with you? Can't you stop gambling? What are you, an idiot? No. You need to call somebody up that'll tell you, listen, you go buy that one lottery ticket, you could lose your house tonight. Keep calling me. Let me help you through this. I know I've walked this path myself, and that's, I'm saying that's what somebody could tell somebody. I've done this, and this is what's worked. I've done this, and this is what hasn't worked. I believe support is the key. Because I'll say it again, Bob, you know, addictions, it's easy to stop. What's tough with addictions is to stay stopped. And that's why you need to be surrounded by recovering people until you develop, well, always, but you need to develop healthy habits, just like children. Just like my son decided on his own, I'm not hanging out with this kid, with these kids. He made the healthy decision on his own. So recovering addicts need that support group. They need to be accountable, left to their own devices. They may go back to their gambling again. And I want to tell you something else about support that's very funny. A lot of people that I help that are compulsive gamblers, way before they go back to gambling, they've eliminated their support group. They've eliminated their witnesses. Their witnesses are the people that know them well, that know they're compulsive gamblers or alcoholics. They know they can't take just that one drink. So in order to have a slip, days before that, I have to start to eliminate those like-minded people. So there's a lot of red flags that happen before I go and make that bet again.
So those red flags, should they be picked up by family?
Well, what I do with clients is I have them, I give them a piece of paper where they check off what they've done that day. It's real quick. Did I go to a meeting that day? Did I call somebody in recovery that day? Check, check. Did I, whatever, did I do something I like to do that day? Did I pray that day, if they're spiritual? So there's a whole list of things, and they just put checks on it. So what's happening is every day they take a look at that list. And if they start to see that that list is diminishing, there's a good shot they're already planning to gamble before they even make the bet. You follow?
Mm-hmm. This time of the year, for somebody who's a compulsive gambler, what's that really like?
Oh, it's crazy. I got to tell you, I remembered the Super Bowl when I was gambling, and you could bet the coin toss. You could bet the under-over in the first quarter. You could bet you could bet who goes to the bathroom first. I mean, it's crazy, all the bets that you could make in the Super Bowl. And I just remembered because, again, a compulsive gambler can't stop. And betting, and I didn't even know what I was betting half the time. I needed a piece of paper and pen just to remember that I bet who was going to score. I mean, it gets crazy. And the endorphins, the chemicals inside of an addict are going nuts. I mean, you're like, you're going crazy. And, you know, again, it's just overpowering. It was more powerful than I could handle. And at the end of the day, when I would add up how much I bet, I was like insane figures. But you see, that's what I mean. It was constantly trying to fill something. It really wasn't to win anything. I'm a diehard Giant fan. I love the Giants, and I remember when the with Lawrence Taylor that first Super Bowl, I got to that Super Bowl and I had no money left to bet. Here I am, a diehard Giant fan. I'm betting everything from Hawaii in the middle of the night at 2:30 to anything that you could bet on TV.
Mm-hmm.
The Giants get to the Super Bowl and I was out of money. I mean, it just. No, it wasn't funny, but it just shows you the nature of how powerful the addiction is.
Mm. So when you talk about this concept of, you know, and we've had people on this program talk before. We've actually had people call into the program who literally are, in some cases, going to meetings. The power of that kind of an environment for somebody who is an addict, is there any way to explain that?
Yeah, here's how I would explain it to somebody who's not an addict, okay? The addiction becomes like oxygen. If I said to you, Bob, you're not going to have oxygen in an hour, I think you'd be pretty scared, and you get desperate, and you get to that point of, oh, my God, I'm going to die.
Now,
yeah, intellectually, addiction is not an intellectual problem. Intellectually, we know that if I don't get my bets in at 1 o'clock, I'm not going to die, intellectually. But there's an emotional attachment to it that's so powerful, you literally feel like I'm not going to be able to live. And the only way I could describe that to people that aren't addicts is it almost becomes like oxygen. It almost becomes like I cannot live without that drink, without that bet, without that drug, so on and so forth. And that's the only way I can explain it to somebody who's not an addict. It becomes an emotional oxygen to them. Because what addiction is, it's really an emotional disconnection is what it is. You're emotionally connected to whatever that addiction is instead of emotionally connected to human beings. You stopped trusting them a long time ago. That's, and when I say stop trusting them, Bob, I don't mean that you can't be a regular Joe and be nice and be kind and wear a wonderful mask. I mean internally, because all addicts are fragmented. You know, people that are healthy people are congruent. They're one person. Who you see is who they are. Addicts early on from childhood start to become fragmented. They start to split off. They have two worlds, one they show the world and one they live inside. What I do in my groups is I bring that inside world to the light. I bring it out with other people so you find acceptance again. You understand that I'm not a bad person. You understand what I mean, Bob?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
You feel like, you know what, I'm okay. But addicts early on, they keep that fragmentation going, and that's what really kills them. That's why they look for these outside sources to give them what they really didn't receive early on.
With the economic conditions in this country, many states, including the one that you live in, and I live in, because it's the same state, have legalized forms of gambling. Many states have lotteries. Obviously, a lot of states also have casinos. Legalized forms of gambling there. How does that also impact the world of somebody who's dealing with an addiction like this?
It just fuels the fire. It really does. It's not the doesn't cause the fire, but it certainly fuels it. You know, when you need help, when you don't have the power to stop something, and then you find arenas that can feed that addiction, that can feed that, it doesn't help. And especially, like, you know, having financial problems or living, as you said, in economic problems today, it also isn't the fire, but it fuels the fire. You know, the thought in the beginning is maybe if I win a few bets, I can pay for my bills or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It also can fuel the fire. It gives you more of a permission to act in destructive ways, if you follow me. I call it destructive entitlement, where you don't realize that, you know, your mind is really lying to you that, you know, I'm entitled to do this because I need to do this, because I need to pay my bills, because I don't have enough money. And it gives you an entitlement that turns out to be destructive.
You know, we saw the fervor that took place. Really, it was only a couple of weeks ago. I mean, in a way, it seems like it was a month ago. But realistically, I think it was only about 2 weeks ago. With the Powerball,
mm-hmm.
the jackpot,
mm-hmm.
you know, and people were spending money on tickets
right.
in an enormous fashion. Okay?
Right.
And I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I've never gambled.
Right.
Because I'll be bluntly honest with you, I had a couple of tickets in
right.
the Powerball.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I didn't go out and spend hundreds of dollars
exactly.
on them. Okay.
Right.
And I was online buying one ticket in the store where I do buy them, near where I live. There was a guy in front of me. It was at night. He bought 80 tickets. 80 tickets. And I was watching him pulling out the cash to do this, and his hands were literally shaking
yep.
as he was doing it.
Yep.
He got all the tickets, and then I saw him start to dig in his pockets for tickets from other games in the New Jersey lottery.
Right.
And he's going over to the machine because they have the type of machine where you can go and scan your old tickets to see if they've won. And as I was buying my ticket, I was counting how many tickets he was doing through the scan thing there. He had 25 tickets. Not one of them with a win. And the look on his face at that point...
It's not fun anymore.
...said an awful lot there. And I just thought to myself, you know, I'm not a prohibitionist. I know some people like to do this. But I also wonder whether or not, and it's bothered me since that time, whether or not he was taking money from something else to do that. And I thought also of that $25 that really was wasted. As well, too. That's just stuck with me since that time.
It is when you see the reality of it in the experience you saw, the sadness of it. It's not fun. To buy a lottery ticket and to have that fantasy, what would I do with a gazillion dollars?
Right.
You know, of course, everybody has it. But, you know, I wonder, you know, if his children had food that night.
Exactly.
Mean, it sounds crazy.
You do. You have to wonder those sort of things.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Know what's going on with your favorite artists, bands, and celebs. Sign up today to get the Radio.com daily newsletter, which covers all your breaking music and entertainment news. Go to Radio.com/newsletter to get updates directly to your inbox. That's Radio.com/newsletter.
Listen to CBS Sports Radio every weekend for nonstop sports updates and breaking news, including analysis of the hottest topics in sports.
CBS Sports Radio.
CBS Sports Radio.
Listen live every weekend on air or online at CBSSportsRadio.com.
We're in discussion with Thomas Gagliano on our program. He's an addiction specialist, life coach, and author, keynote speaker. His first book was entitled The Problem Was Me. ThomasGagliano.com, a website where you can go and find out some information about Tom. He has shared a lot with us in our discussion. We've been talking about this topic of addiction. Specifically, I wanted to do the focus today on the area of gambling addiction with, obviously, the Super Bowl right around the corner. This idea of borrowing money, and specifically those who wind up borrowing money, shall we say, from the wrong people, how often does that really occur?
Oh, it occurs quite often. I mean, you know, again, money to a gambler is like cocaine to a drug addict, and, you know, you're going to go to whatever lengths you can. I mean, this is where the addiction is controlling the person when the person thinks they're in control of the addiction. You know, I'm sure many people that have borrowed money from the wrong people never thought that that would happen when they started gambling. But the addiction has to keep getting fed, so you cross lines and you cross lines. And, you know, the sad thing is you get yourself into a situation where you can do illegal things then to get the money that you need. And like that gentleman that you saw buying all those lottery tickets, you know, I don't know this man, but doesn't mean this is a bad guy. This mm-hmm. could be a very good person. He could be a very loving person. But, when you are an addict, the addiction comes first. It comes before your family, yourself, and everything else. So it's, I mean, that's just what happens. And you'll go to any lengths to get money, any lengths at all. You'll steal from your kids. You'll steal from your boss. You'll do whatever you can. So going to a loan shark or going to the wrong people to get money, it's just one of the things that you do.
This proliferation, shall we say, of forms of gambling. You know, we talked a little bit about the lotteries. Obviously, the casinos have been around for some time. And then we step into this whole online world of betting.
Right.
And listen, there's been plenty of discussion, and let's be bluntly honest about it, advertising at points on this station with some of the sites like DraftKings, FanDuel,
right,
et cetera. How has this impacted, how is this impacting the lives of those who have some serious problems with gambling addiction?
Well, what it's done is it's brought the gambling to the person, which makes it much more convenient. You know, I'm clean since 93. For me to go gamble, I had to go find a phone booth. I'm a dinosaur, Bob. I had to go find a phone booth. I didn't have cell phones. I had to call the bookie back, see the line changes, call the bookie back. I was always carrying like a roll of quarters in my car. Not today. Look, the computer makes it very easy to gamble. It makes it very easy to grab a hold of pornography. It makes it very easy to spend money that you may not have, okay, all these addictions. And especially gambling, you could sit at home and you can just feast away and not have to move. And again, all that does, it makes it more convenient and makes it easier. It just, again, fuels the problem.
Fantasy football has taken off like gangbusters. A lot of talk about it, obviously, in circles like on air here, WFAN at times. What does that do? What has that done?
I think, you know, we look back at anything, and it's not the what has that done. It more pertains to the individual than what has that done. Again, when a person has boundaries, when a person, you can have fun with all these things. You can enjoy it. You know, all of the things we spoke about on the show, if a person has boundaries, if a person is congruent, he can have fun with all of these things. But when you get somebody who's broken inside and you're putting all these things there, then it becomes compulsive. And what does compulsive mean? Compulsive means it's making your life unmanageable. If I'm doing all of this stuff and I have a wife downstairs that doesn't know what I look like because I'm not around, you know, and I have kids that are like, you know, who's that guy that walks around this house? Is that dad? You know, if I'm doing anything to the point that I'm making my life unmanageable, I'm taking time away from my family, then I have to look at that. Because then again, you know, the child says, again, what's the matter with me? Why doesn't dad pay attention to me? And anything that we do, so it's really not so much the external situation. It's really who the person is. If you do it in a way where it's fun and you frame your time around it, that you're not taking time away from your family or the people that you care about, or you're not spending money you don't have, there's nothing wrong with it. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there that are broken inside, as we've been talking about, and then it could become compulsive, and then it makes your life unmanageable.
I purposely have not mentioned or used the term relapse during this discussion. I say that word to you. How do you explain what relapse is?
Relapse is, as I said, stopping isn't tough. It's staying stopped. Relapse is when somebody is in recovery, doing well, starts to understand, hey, you know what, maybe this addiction's not oxygen. Maybe I could live without it. And they're doing well, and they're connected to their support group. That's the key, as you mentioned earlier. And then all of a sudden, they get complacent. All of a sudden, they start to say, you know what, I can handle this. You know what, I can handle buying one lottery ticket. You know what? I can handle one glass of wine. Maybe I could smoke one joint. I don't know if they call them joints, but I can handle it. That's when relapse starts, when the person starts to tell themselves again, I can handle it. But in order to do that, Bob, you have to eliminate whatever recovery program you're connected to. You follow me?
Mm-hmm. I do follow you, definitely. And that's very key. Now, when we talk about that idea of support recovery programs, we also need to talk about the family and the role of a spouse or significant other,
yes,
and also children,
yes,
in that process of recovery.
Right. Right.
What's that really like?
You know, the co-addict or the wife of the compulsive gambler or the husband of the compulsive gambler also has to look at their actions too. Are they enabling the disease to continue? Are they making excuses for the person that's gambling. Like, oh, he's just having fun or she's just having fun. Or, you know, let's not tell anybody about this. Or there's all kinds of ways that a wife or a husband can also enable the person to stay in their disease. Sometimes, you know, like I said to you before, what changed me? Consequences, life on life's terms. My wife left me. Sometimes a gambler needs consequences. Sometimes gamblers need consequences. You know, maybe the wife or the husband has to say, look, I'm not happy and I'm not doing this anymore. You get help or I'm out of this. Sometimes you need that push from the other end. Because if you don't get the push from the other end, let's face it, that's why we have jails and stuff. You know, you need consequences. Everybody does. And if you're in a relationship where the gambling comes first and you're not happy with that, you have one of three choices. You could stay in that relationship, or you could say, listen, if we don't get help, I'm getting out of that relationship. And the other choice is really just to, it's just to hang around and or just to get a divorce. I'm sorry, that's the last, or I'm out of this. I'm out of it. I'm done. So, again, there is a role that the spouse plays as well in determining also bringing the consequences to the surface and say, listen, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not doing this anymore.
So in this week leading up to the Super Bowl, and the hype goes through the roof, okay? You know, there's focus on the game. There's focus on all these activities surrounding the game. There's focus on halftime entertainment. You know, this is a major production. It's something which will spur betting that is not in the millions, but in the billions of dollars, literally around the world. There's going to be a phenomenal number of people watching this game next week who, in many cases, have an interest in it. And I mean a financial interest in this. As that hype builds, what advice can you give to somebody who is dealing with exactly what you've been talking about?
Well, you know, there's a point that a gambler compulsive is going to gamble, and there's nothing in the world that's going to stop them when they've reached that point. Probably most people that are going to go nuts on the Super Bowl, bet money they don't have, are going to do that already. My advice to them is, and if you go to 12-step programs the day after the Super Bowl or the week after the Super Bowl, you'll see the rooms filled, which tells you something. My advice is, it's very difficult, and it was hard for me to reach out to other people. One of the toughest things I ever did. Again, I didn't trust anybody to be in control of the process. I needed to be in control because, again, in my early days, in my childhood, if I didn't control it, something bad was going to happen. So letting go of that and asking for help and reaching out, for me, was a very difficult task, and I think it's very difficult for most addicts. But again, we need to let other people nurse us to health. We can't do it alone.
Hold that thought.
Want great deals on products and unique experiences in your neighborhood? Look no further than CBS Local Offers, which brings you the best local deals in your community with everything from enticing restaurants to exciting events. Go to offers.cbslocal.com today.
There's something for every sports fan on CBSLocalSports.com. Watch live radio shows and original video programming while reading national articles from some of the best writers in the country. Visit CBSLocalSports.com today.
We're in discussion with Tom Gagliano on our program. Tom is an addiction specialist, an author, a keynote speaker, a life coach. His first book was entitled The Problem Was Me. He's joined us on our program talking with us about the topic of addiction, specifically gambling addiction. Obviously, in this week leading up to the Super Bowl, I was asking you about, you know, some advice that you could give to those who are dealing with problems when it comes to gambling along the lines of the things that you've shared with us. Before we paused, you were kind of in the middle of answering that question. Do you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, it's funny. A client of mine texted me during the break, and he said, you got to tell him that this is all about control. And, you know, when a guy has just gotten to that bottom and is in a lot of trouble in the areas we've discussed. The realization is, you know, my best thinking may not be working here, and I need to allow other people into my life, which is very difficult for people that have lost trust in other people early on. But I can tell them that it's a huge step to take a step forward and to ask for help. And the thing is, you may not feel like doing it. You probably won't. But it's one of those things, Bob, in your life that you got to do what you don't feel like doing. Just get your feet there, because your head's not going to be the best part of getting you there. And if you can do that, if you can take a step towards a 12-step meeting, 1-800-GAMBLER, or even women married or men married to gamblers, they can go to Gammonon. If they take a step towards a 12-step meeting or towards a therapist and making that call, it's scary. It's scary, but that's going to be the beginning of really building growth and really freeing yourself from the prison of gambling.
And that first step, keeping with that, how difficult does that become?
Oh, it's huge. Again, it's like I have to trust people again. And it's trusting them from the inside, not the outside, not telling them, you know, what the Giants are doing this week or the Yankees, or it's not about the stocks. It's talking about your feelings, your inside, that fragmentation I said to you. When I have clients talk about what's going on the inside, and I get their insides to come out, so they match a little bit better. Their insides and outsides match now. They're talking about their insides. You could actually see in their face how freeing that is. And that's really the first step towards, you know, healing yourself, healing what's broken inside. And from there, again, if you stay connected to the like-minded people, and you need to build a support group, miracles happen. I've seen them all the time.
You yourself, when it comes to Super Bowl Sunday, how do you handle it? And what do you do?
Well, you know, I haven't gambled in many, many years, thank God. And I had to go a whole year without looking at the newspaper and looking at lines. I had to just stop that. I would watch the Giants, the Yankees, the Knicks, the teams I liked, only those teams. I wouldn't be putting on another football game because my mind would go in the wrong. I wonder what the line is. I wonder all that stuff, all that jargon. And I had to do that for about a year. Maybe 6 months. I couldn't look at lines. Now, I watch what I want to watch. I can open up the paper. There's no problem. If my eyes hit lines, I'm not thinking about betting. I don't have that pull anymore. I enjoy sports. I love sports. My kids played sports. I was played sports my whole life. I can watch anything now and not have those urges because it's not connected on filling a void inside. I just enjoy the game.
And at the heart, you know, that's something that when we're first exposed to sports as children, that's kind of at the heart of what the whole experience is supposed to be about.
Yeah, well, you know, for me, and I'm sure other people, sports saved my childhood. I mean, I had a bad childhood. Mm-hmm. When I was playing ball, I was good in sports. People knew it. They acknowledged me. I was popular from sports. Sports saved my life earlier on. Saved my life. It made me feel whole. It was something that was a positive outlet. Unfortunately, because I had that damage inside, you know, the betting aspect of it was, again, going back to filling a void, and I ruined it in that regard. But early on, sports saved my life. It's what kept me away from, you know, my family and the insanity going on in my family. It gave me, you know, integrity, self-esteem. It was wonderful.
For someone who's listening, who's a spouse, perhaps a child of somebody who's exhibiting the behaviors along the lines that you've talked about, is there a way for them to begin the discussion on that?
Well, you can begin the discussion, and the discussion can be telling them how you feel. You're talking about a spouse now?
Mm-hmm. Or yeah. Child.
Or child. Well, a child can't go to a parent. A parent needs to create the safe place for the child. You know, the parent needs to go to the child and to be curious, explore. How do you feel? What's going on with you? You know, if the child is safe enough to talk to the parent, The child will tell the parent how they feel, but the parent has to set that environment up, that environment of safety up. Now, as far as the spouse goes, you know, unfortunately, many times if it's addiction, there's got to be consequences. And as I said before, you may have to have the conversation is, I can't do this anymore. If you don't get help, I need to leave this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That may be the conversation that needs to take place in order to see an action take place.
Very interesting discussion with Tom Gagliano on our program. He's a life coach and addiction specialist. His first book is entitled The Problem Was Me. Thomas Gagliano, that's all, is oneword.com website. He's talked with us about this topic of addiction, specifically gambling addiction, and this period of time leading up to the Super Bowl. In having discussions like the one we have today, does this also help your recovery process?
Yeah, you know, because I facilitate groups and do these things, and I talk about these things on the radio all the time, it helps me to understand and keep my values in place.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's kind of like eliminating my witnesses. If I start talking about this for myself and start seeing the consequences of all addictions on family, especially on children, that's, you know, I know for me, Bob, personally, when I make a difference in a child's life, when my clients start to tell me that the conversations they had with their children, where they really grow close with their children, they share their feelings, their children share their feelings, that gives me such gratification because, you know, the messages that we hand down to our child could be handed down from generation to generation to generation. If I have a minute, I'm going to just tell you a beautiful story.
Unfortunately, we're plumb out of time here. I'm sorry to do that to you. Tom, thank you very much for joining us on our program. Certainly continued good health to you, too.
Thank you, Bob. Take care.